Hello again, Bob Chaundy here with another Considering Art podcast, in which I talk to an artist about their work and something of their life. My guest today is the painter and sculptor Romany Mark Bruce. Romany describes himself as a sculptor who paints. Back in the 1980s, he would have described himself as a lawyer, since that was his profession before turning to art, which had been a long-held interest. Romany's most celebrated work is his 2009 Brighton & Hove AIDS Memorial, which stands in New Stein Gardens in Brighton. Romany's best friend Paul Tay had died from AIDS some years earlier, and the sculpture offers a point of grieving for those lost to the epidemic. Romany's sculptures embrace the human form, and his paintings reveal his obsession with colour. They're much sought after by collectors around the world. Romany has led a fascinating life, as I discovered when I talked to him from his Brighton home. Romany, welcome to the Considering Art podcast. You're the first Romany I've ever met.
Yes, not many of us around.
Okay. Now, you were born in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. I mean, other than the general, did they impact you at all personally?
They impacted everyone personally. To some extent, yes, I grew up in Lisburn, right beside the Thiepval Barracks. And my maths teacher was the first person to be injured in a car bomb. She was blown out a window, choosing her wedding dress, and lost her leg. But yes, businesses were impacted. So it was something that was ever present. And I doubt if anybody growing up where I grew up knew somebody that wasn't injured or killed or significantly impacted by the trouble. So it was ever present, but it was normal life.
Yeah. You went to a Quaker school, which is interesting because, of course, Quakers are pacifists, aren't they? And yet they're existing in a war situation, really.
They are, and it was an interesting school to attend. So United Nations Day was the biggest day of celebration in the school. And so I think it was a healthy, very healthy environment for education, given that although it was primarily a Protestant school, I was not aware of that. I didn't really understand. I never knew who was what religion growing up, partly to do with my parents and very much partly to do with the school, who were welcoming to everyone, which I later understood was quite unusual.
Mm. Did they encourage your art?
Not at all. I was called into the headmaster's office when I asked if I could do A-level art in my free time, as I'd done my O-level art in my free time. And his words were, "We've humoured you long enough, and what you've got to understand is that art is for people who aren't very bright." And that was that.
Oh dear. So did you sort of pursue it privately then?
I didn't have time to study for my art level or to A level, and they wouldn't allow me to. And I very much wanted to be a lawyer, so it wasn't a problem at the time. And in the 1970s, I think certainly in Ireland, the art wasn't pushed. Visual arts were not high on the agenda. Writing and music very much so, but not visual arts. So it wasn't encouraged, and so I didn't really feel bad or either way about it. I just accepted that I was quite bright, I knew I was going to go to university, and I was excited about the prospect of studying law.
I'm sure your parents were happy.
They would have allowed me to do anything. My father was passionate about the arts, particularly visual art. He supported a very well-known artist, Basil Blackshaw, who in Ireland is very well known. His palette was our table from our dining room in my father's shop, and my father allowed him space to paint when he wasn't well known and had no money. So my parents would have allowed me to do anything as long as I was happy.
However, you did study law. Any specific area of law?
Yes, I come from a background of doctors, especially in my extended family. I knew I was very interested in medicine, decided to study medico-legal law because of my interest in medicine, but I was no good at science. So I specialised in clinical negligence, medical negligence as it was known then, specialised in pharmaceutical litigation, and then later acquired brain injury litigation.
Did you have to study anatomy for that?
I didn't really have to study anatomy, but I've always been interested in anatomy. So I studied lots of things that I needed. And when you start off in that area, you do start off doing personal injury claims, which generally involves orthopedics. So anatomy was always fascinating to me from an early age.
So in a strange way, it might have had an influence on your future art career.
I very much think so. People think that my career in art and my career in law are polar opposites, but I don't really accept that. There is creativity to litigation and working with words. So much of my job was being a wordsmith. Negotiating was all to do with using words. So there was a creativity to my work that I don't think even some lawyers don't understand.
Hmm. Now, you did some paralegal work in Dallas, Texas. What took you over there?
I missed a boat hitchhiking to Ireland, met a chap who was also hitchhiking, and his father was an attorney, gave me his father's business card. So 3 years later, I just still had this card in my wallet, and I wrote to him and suggested he give me a job, which he did. So a very tenuous link.
Yeah, it's an interesting to compare the different systems, I guess.
Very interesting. And he wanted me to stay in America, and he was willing to put me through law school. But in the 1980s, the lack of culture and the gun laws and the racism were things that put me off staying there. So I chose not to.
Talking of gun laws, I gather you got robbed at gunpoint in New York on the way back.
No, it was a knife. It was,
right.
Was foolish and very green. I was asked to hand over my camera. I didn't see the knife at first, and I told the chap where to go. He had already made me hand over my wallet and other things, but I had taken a roll of film at the Guggenheim of an Eve Klein exhibition, and I think it was the nearest I felt that I'd had to a religious experience, because I've always been interested in architecture. So he didn't get the camera. It was a foolish decision. Decision on my part, but it worked out well in the end.
Yeah, it worked out well because you kept the whatever photos you'd taken on it.
I did. Photography was my first love, and then I got into sculpting. But I had an exhibition of the photographs from that roll of film. It was the film that I was disturbed about losing, not the camera, when he asked me to hand it over. So yeah, 13 years later, I had an exhibition of those photographs.
So anyway, you spent a decade or so working as a clinical negligence lawyer. So how did you get into art and specifically sculpture?
Well, when I was in London working very hard as a lawyer in the late 80s, I wanted to sign up for a photography class in the days when night classes were very accessible to everyone. But the photography class was full. So I signed up for the sculpture class, which is across the corridor, thinking that I would transfer to the photography class when people, as they do, inevitably drop out. But I never did, because I became obsessed very quickly in, I think it was only one or two terms. I just didn't have time to do it. But I knew that it was something that I had to do. So it was very instantaneous, my love.
What was the attraction, Romani?
Gosh, I felt it was something that I could do. I don't know. I don't know what was the attraction. I think maybe being a bit messy. We were presented with a live model, so my interest in anatomy fed through, but these weren't things that I was processing at the time. I just knew it was something that I absolutely had to do.
Mm. And did you work in mainly in clay, I suppose?
Generally, I've worked in clay all my life, yes. It's fast. It's like painting. We'll probably come on to our work in acrylics. I like to work fast, and I like to work in some sort of chaos, and I'm not a planner. So it's a medium that suits the way I work.
And so often your pieces will evolve in a necessarily unplanned way.
Yes, which is very unhelpful when you have to build an armature to support the clay. So often I would have to rejig my armature, which would be a very difficult and challenging task. Sometimes it just wouldn't work and I'd have to start again. Yes, it would be easier to be someone who planned their work and was more methodical, but it's not for me.
Right. Well, you started sculpting full time. Lots of figurative torsos. Was it? Did you cast most of them into bronze?
Bronze and cold bronze resin. It started, now we have acrylic resins, which are much easier to work with. But in the old days, I was overcome by fumes once and just slid to the floor in my studio. And then I started filling my negative spaces with broken windscreen glass and chopped copper.
Chopped copper? Where did that idea come from?
Well, the idea for this came from looking at an Andy Warhol exhibition, and that's when he was using copper paint, and then he was urinating on the copper paint to oxidize it. And I don't come out of this very well, but I just marveled at the signs which labeled them as copper paint and piss. And I knew that my mother would be utterly appalled if she read any such thing. And I knew that she'd be coming to an exhibition. So I did it out of badness to upset my mother. That's where it came from. The urinating didn't work. I had to use copper sulfate spray because it just wasn't working.
But Andy Warhol is not normally an influence on sculptors, I would guess. So did you have any other influences then too?
Oh, my first obsession was Rodin. And I think I got every book possible on Rodin because of the interest in anatomy. So I spent a lot of time studying his work. And then bizarrely, my great interest was minimalism in the 1980s and Carl Andre and Saul LeWitt, all the minimalist installationists and sculptors. So that was, but how that feeds into my work, I'm not sure, because I don't think I've ever been able to use a straight line in anything I produced.
In 1992, your best friend Paul Tay died from AIDS at a time when there was still a stigma surrounding the disease. That must have been a hell of a shock for you.
It was. It was devastating. He was we were partners for a while, but he was really my best friend and soulmate. So I was devastated, and in anticipation of this podcast, I was thinking about this in the middle of the night. And I think that what I felt when he died was that I would never be whole again. I was worried that I would forget him. And in fact, his death has made me feel whole, which was bizarre when I think of the place I was at the time. But he gave me the courage of my convictions and to follow what I wanted to do. So I believe that everything has happened as a consequence of his death in a very positive way.
In that case, did he crystallize your thoughts at the time of becoming a full-time artist?
No, not really. He crystallized my thoughts of not being ashamed of being gay and being open about that, but not banging on about it, because I would not like to think that's what defines me. But I think he gave me courage to believe in myself. But I didn't decide then that I would be an artist. In fact, I had just started going to sculpture night classes. But it fed into what happened later in life.
Because you unveiled an AIDS memorial sculpture in 2009, that was, I suppose, partly a memorial for him, but more for AIDS victims in general, I guess. How did it come about?
It came about because there had been a public competition going on for some time, about 9 months, which I didn't know about. I didn't read the gay press. The editor of the magazine promoting it, James Ledward, he was unknown to me, but he stopped me in the street and jabbed a finger at me late one night and said, "I know who you are. I want a word with you." I had no idea what this man was up to, what he wanted, but he was concerned that the submissions for the competition were design companies, artists from outside the area. He felt that he wanted some input and at least a submission by a local gay artist with a connection to the town. Very quickly, the competition closed in a week or 10 days. And of great fortune, I was going on holiday to Pietrasanta in northern Italy, which is the centre of the stone carving industry near the Carrara marble mines. So I was surrounded by great inspiration. So I cobbled something together in that week and submitted it. I had no experience of a public sculpture or budgeting or where it would be placed. So, but working under pressure isn't a bad thing.
So what was the concept behind your work, which consists of one male figure and another androgynous figure soaring into the sky? It's 4 meters high, I believe.
It is. It wasn't 4 meters when I put in the submission because there wasn't enough money. It was going to be relatively small, but it grew when the funds grew. I grew up in the Troubles. There's a very significant sculpture in Belfast of a woman being blown off her feet by a bomb. What I did is I visited public sculptures in my head that had had an impact of me. That one had an impact, but I knew that I didn't want my sculpture to be depressing because there have been great advancements in HIV medication, and there was great hope at the time, even though it was the 2000s. And the other public sculpture that really resonated with me was the memorial to JFK, John F. Kennedy, in Dallas, outside the courthouse where I would work. And it's three concrete walls with a tomb in the middle with the flame representing the fallen warriors. And it's so quiet and powerful. I wanted something that would make people contemplate, but they would make them look up with hope. The two figures represent two people whose lives have crossed. They may not know each other. They may not know each other's names. If you follow the trajectory of the two curved figures, you never know whether they will meet again or not, whether their paths will cross. And because most of the people who have died of AIDS and affected by HIV in Brighton have been men, one was a male figure, but the other one was to represent everyone else, be it in Brighton, be it in Africa, be it around the world, wherever.
And the sculpture has become something of a community landmark.
It has. Every year, World AIDS Day, there is a large vigil where the names of people who have died are read out. So it's become quite a powerful meeting point, yes, which I didn't expect.
And you've also become involved, haven't you, in the HIV/AIDS awareness campaign that was started by the Body Shop. What did that entail?
Well, that was exciting. That entailed me going to London, being met by a car and taken to the studios of Rankin, the photographer, the very famous Britain's probably most prominent portrait photographer. And there were 28 of us. Annie Lennox, as HIV ambassador of UNAIDS, was one. And the rest of us, we were all photographed for a campaign by the Body Shop. And we were blown up onto 9-foot posters and placed around the world in 3,000 body shops. So it was one of the many very significant campaigns run by the Body Shop charity section.
Meanwhile, you gave up sculpture for painting, didn't you, for a while? What brought that on?
I had a very good friend, Kathy, who was trained as an artist. She went to art college, and she pointed out that I was obsessed with colour, but I was working in clay, and there was no colour involved. Maybe casting in the bronze and broken windscreen, there was some colour. So I tried my hand at painting and liked it and became quite obsessed with that. So the reason I gave up sculpture was, one, I was having problems with my hands with a repetitive strain injury, but more significantly, there isn't room in my head to both paint and sculpt at the same time. So I had to leave this sculpting behind. So I can either do one or the other, but I can't do them both at once.
How did your friend know that you were obsessed with colour if you were working in clay?
Well, she knew that everywhere I went, I took emulsion paint colour charts with me. And if I bought a pot of paint, I would sometimes take it into the office just to take the top off and look at it. So she knew that it was an obsession.
But some of your paintings have this great energy and movement about them, you know, the turbulence of boats at sea, the blurring of insects' wings. That's something that you incorporate, isn't it, into your works?
I discovered that I'm finding my way. I'm completely self-taught at painting, so I've never really known what I'm doing. And then one day I got locked in my house and my key snapped in the lock, I was supposed to go to a drinks party, but really didn't want to. But I thought I have to use my time wisely. And a painting emerged from nowhere. It sounds slightly corny, but it's what happened. And I realized that in my, not anger is overstating it, but in my frustration and expending this energy, I was painting the way I sculpt with palette knives, with great energy. And so I consider myself to be a sculptor who paints, not a painter. And I realized that once I started to approach it in the same way as I do sculpting, that it worked.
And lockdown made you concentrate on nature.
That was just an episode. I find lockdown difficult, as most people did. I had just had to come back from Italy, where I had gone to sculpt for 2 years, but had to come back because of the pandemic. And I think just being outside and amongst nature, and something in my head wanted me to be quite peaceful and positive. But I do have a good friend who said she was much happier when I went back to my slightly darker work, which is where she believes is a world that I inhabit more comfortably.
Well, talking of that darker work, I mean, your portraits, if you can call them that, are expressionistic. Their faces are often disfigured, often with colour. I can see the influence of Francis Bacon there.
Great influence, yes, yes. That an obsession. Francis Bacon's work is an obsession. Many, many books on my bookshelves. I mean, it's not something that I have set out to draw inspiration from or try and emulate, but there are parallels which, you know, clearly I've been influenced by the amount that I've read and looked at.
I mean, his works are full of kind of implicit sexual violence and anger. I don't quite get that from your work.
I have had people say that I must be a bit disturbed to produce the paintings that I do. That's just what other people say. I had an exhibition that I was sitting in on, and two ladies came in. They didn't know that I was the artist, and one just said, "It might be quite good, but I hope I never get to meet him. He's clearly very disturbed." So some people do think that there's a tension and an angst in particularly my sculptures, more so than my paintings. Mm. I'm happy for people to believe what they want to believe.
Colour to you, does that speak of emotion and maybe certain messages?
Well, I believe that being a sculptor is who you are and painting is where you are at a given time. So I do think there's a lot of tension and maybe slight torture in my sculptures, and there always has been. So the comment was made about my sculptures by the lady I referred to, and I accept that fully. And interestingly, my lighter, more accessible paintings were done during the pandemic, when you would think I would be a bit darker, but that's not the case. But I think painting is where I am at a given time rather than who I am.
Mm. I'd like to ask you about your series Unseen.
Yes.
The eyes are very much highlighted. Are you looking there at the way we observe things?
The way I observe things are the way we fail to observe things. So that hence the title of the collection, because the UN of On is in brackets. So this just happened. As all my work just happens, I can't really control what's coming out when I start a new collection. But I realized that the eyes were either hidden or shrouded or masked. There was a significance in how I approached the area of the eyes that I didn't plan, but it then developed as a theme.
Mm.
So I think it's about understanding how we look at the world or how we fail to look at the world, or we're unwilling to look at the world. And I think this has come from me being more involved in social media over the years, like most people. And there seems to either people lie about who they are and what they are and what they're doing, or they fail to acknowledge what's going on around them. So that's the essence of that body of work.
Yeah, people create images of themselves for other people
that are untrue or manipulated. And then a lot of people, well, not just social media, but in the mainline news, they don't want to acknowledge it because of what's going on in the world and so many distressing events. So many of us are hooded, metaphorically, and aren't willing to acknowledge what's going on in the world because we can't face it and we're hiding from it.
And we also hide into the social media echo chambers, don't we?
Exactly, yes.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about theatre set design, which you did for the Brighton Theatre Company. Reminds me of David Hockney, who was very big on that. What do you think? What are the requirements of designing sets?
Oh, gosh, patience and understanding other people's egos. But just as you mentioned, David Hockney, when he designed the set for The Magic Flute in the 80s, and there was a big spread about it in the Sunday Times magazine, that always lived with me, how wonderful to be able to explore a different area and a different medium. I really enjoyed it, but I did 5 theatre set designs, and I realised that there's so much time is spent working around other people and fitting in with other people and dealing with people who become quite emotional about their involvement or their frustration and not being able to get on with what they want to do, be it the director wanting to hold rehearsals or the lighting men wanting to organise the lighting. So there's quite a lot of screaming and shouting and I need to get on with what I need to do. I find that quite challenging because my work is solitary other than it hanging an exhibition and working with the curator. So I'm really pleased that I tried it. I wouldn't want it to be my profession full time.
I imagine you're working on a much bigger scale, though.
It was a small theatre production, so not a huge scale, but I did an installation at the New Haven Ford, and it was very topical. It was a play that a friend of mine had written, Richard Crane, about Gaza and a UN food distribution warehouse being burnt down called I Am a Warehouse. And this was years ago. It would have been very powerful now, but it was still powerful at the time. So I had a huge area to create installations. So that was quite overwhelming, but we managed it.
You say your arts is a very solitary pursuit, but I always find with sculptors, because you're working with foundries and so on, there's much more collaboration.
Correct. There is more collaboration, and working with foundries is very, very exciting. I love that bit, especially casting in bronze, because it's as if health and safety doesn't work. You're watching molten bronze being poured at 3,000 degrees Celsius, and there's something very medieval about it, and I love that. But the amount of time that you spend with the foundry isn't huge, so most of my work is very solitary.
You mentioned that you spent a couple of years in Pietrasanta. Did you learn marble carving techniques there? Then have you worked in marble since?
Well, I was in Pietrasanta when I designed Tay, the AIDS memorial. And then I looked after a mother for 5 years who died of Alzheimer's. And then I decided that I had freedom when she died to do something else. And I desperately wanted to get back to sculpting, but because I know that I can't sculpt and paint at the same time, I decided I couldn't even do it in the same place. So I gave up painting to go to live in Pietrasanta for 2 years to carve in marble. But unfortunately, because of the pandemic, I had to come back early. But yes, I was working on the side of a drizzly mountain in northern Tuscany, chipping away by hand at a great big hunk of marble. And I have to say that I have never felt as so content in my life. And I discussed earlier how I tend to work fast when I'm working with energy. Sculpting in marble is very, very different. You sort of go into a trance, and it's all to do with sound. And so it is all to do with the sound of the chisel. And interestingly, the less work you do and the less you achieve, the better work you're doing. So I was very much getting to know my stone, not planning the sculpture, seeing what evolves. Very old school method of approach, but something that worked for me. And it might have taken me a year to finish this piece of sculpture, but I would have been very happy had I been given the chance.
Mm. So what have you got coming up in this new year, Romani?
Well, for the last nearly a year, I've been working on a book. I have a book, I was approached by publishers this time last year to publish a monograph of my work over the last 30 years. So cataloguing that and organizing it has taken up a huge amount of time. But then they decided they wanted to accompany it with a biography. So I spent many months being interviewed by a biographer. Slightly intimidating, being asked about your life. Very personal. I find that a challenge. But the book will be published in May this year, and it's called Sculpt in Colour, because, as I've said, I believe that I'm a sculptor, I'm not a painter. But it covers both aspects of my work, sculpting and painting. And also very much the thread of the narrative in the book is how I have been influenced by the death of my friend Paul Tay, and how he has been responsible for the path that I've taken, which has led me to where I am today.
Well, I hope you haven't found this being too much of a challenge for you. I'm sorry if it is, but thanks so much.
Not at all. I very much enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks so much for doing it.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's been a pleasure.
Romany Mark Bruce, who I should add, gives a proportion of his earnings to HIV/AIDS research. Thank you so much for listening. Join me, Bob Chaundy, again next week.